Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome to JS on Politics, our weekly look at what's happening in Madison and Wisconsin politics. I'm your host, Greg Borowski, and here's a quick look at what's on our show today. We're going to talk about how close are we to having a state budget, an issue that it kind of depends on who you ask these days. We'll look at the fallout from the U.S. Supreme Court decision today on Obamacare. We'll get the latest on Walker's presidential fortunes and hit on a range of issues from the South Carolina flag to the $10 bill with opinion columnists James Causey and Christian Schneider. And, of course, we'll take some reader questions. So if you're watching right now, please send some of those in. But first up, we'll talk about the state budget. And if it feels like we've been here before, we have for the last couple weeks with the issue kind of stalled in Madison. There's difference of views out there on how close we are. Let's go to the tape first of Governor Walker yesterday at a news conference expressing optimism about how close this budget resolution is.
I was just talking with the Senate Majority Leader and the Speaker a day ago. Obviously, I've talked to some lawmakers here, but I think in the next few days, we're likely to see the framework of a budget deal come together, something I believe that can get through the Joint Finance Committee, and then I believe the Senate and the Assembly both will be in a good position to act quickly on that. Obviously, the end of the fiscal year is June 30th, but just to put this in perspective, since 1983, there have only been three budgets signed by June 30th. Two of them were mine. And so while I'd certainly like to have it by then, the reality is that there's an awful lot of hysteria going on in the Capitol, at least in the media and from some of our opponents, acting like this is something where we're going to shut the government down like we do at the federal level. It doesn't happen. If July 1 comes and there's still not a budget signed into the law, the state continues. Unlike the federal government, we continue to operate. We just operate off the current base. And so we're perfectly fine, as we have many a time in the past. Where it gets to be a concern is it has several times in the past in recent history. If it goes into the fall, I have no reason to believe that even if it takes a few days into July, it won't happen into early into July, which still puts us far ahead of the signing that we've had throughout the past couple decades.
Scott Walker, perhaps mindful of the adage that only an optimist can be elected president. We're going to go now to Patrick Marley in Madison. So according to the governor, it's kind of seashells and balloons. They're breaking out the champagne over there. Things are close. Or are you getting a different read of how we're really sitting on the state budget?
Well, that's his impression, that we're just days away from the framework of a deal, is how he put it. But legislative leaders have a very different opinion. They said yesterday, right after he made those comments, Speaker Robin Voss put out a statement saying the governor's more optimistic than I am. Scott Fitzgerald, the Senate Majority Leader, was saying that he did not think that he had the votes even within his own caucus for any budget. They've got three major sticking points. They're continuing to talk. Voss and Fitzgerald were meeting today, so perhaps a breakthrough is imminent, but we could be here for weeks.
Yeah, well, tell us a little bit about the sticking points. So what do you think is, I guess, most likely to unstick first or get move us toward a resolution?
I don't know that we know what's going to unstick first. The three things are kind of intertwined. There's the Bucks deal, which a lot of Republicans in the Senate particularly want taken out of the budget and dealt with as separate legislation. That may yet happen, Fitzgerald says. There's transportation, which is a huge problem with big disagreements. The governor wanted to borrow $1.3 billion for roads. Republicans in the legislature say that's too much. And they want to cut it by perhaps $800 million. To do that, you're going to have to delay projects. The Assembly Republicans say, well, if we're delaying a lot of projects around the state, that has to include the zoo interchange in Milwaukee County. Fitzgerald says that's untenable. Many others, senators, say we can't do that. And so they're trying to find a way to resolve that issue because the Assembly Republicans feel strongly that if we're going to have delays in their districts around the state, that it's got to be felt in southeastern Wisconsin.
And you know, the governor wasn't just optimistic about a budget deal in general. He said he was optimistic that there would soon be an agreement on the zoo interchange. He also said he was cautiously optimistic about the arena deal. So he was saying he was optimistic about all of this stuff. And, you know, while he was saying this, I was at the press conference. I had three things were running through my head. One, he's the only person in the state saying this. Nobody else is saying that we're on the verge of a deal. Two, it seems like he's trying to convince himself that it's okay that he's traveling around the country and this, you know, what one person called today near chaos is going on. And then three, he's almost like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, where he thinks if he wishes for it, it's just going to happen. And he needs it to happen because he has this July 13th date hanging out there that he wants to make his presidential announcement. But, you know, he yesterday was the only one saying that he was optimistic that a deal would be coming within the next few days.
So those watching can insert their own No Place Like Home kind of joke in here if they want to. But tell us, so Dan, what do you think gets this done? Or does it just sort of languish like this for a while?
Well, it'll eventually get done. I mean, every year, there's an impasse. What's different this time is the Republicans control everything, and so people thought it would be an easy deal to work out, but it's just not happened that way. What they'll have to do is eventually rein in some of these ideas. They'll come to a compromise on roads. The arena deal is a much tougher one because everybody knows that it'll have a much tougher time if it's separate legislation.
Yeah, well, Patrick, so to some degree, it feels like, you know, if any one of these issues might be easy enough to resolve by themselves, but they're so intertwined that if you move in one spot on the arena deal, you may lose somebody you need on some other issues. So can you speak a little bit about the sort of the dynamics there in a measure like this where you've got so many pieces at play and so many individuals who are in a position to influence it?
Sure, and don't forget, there's one big piece that we haven't talked about, and that's prevailing wage, which is the sort of minimum wage that's set for construction workers when they build roads and schools and other public buildings. And many Republicans want to repeal that law. Others say we need to keep it in place or maybe modify it, and they're all over the map on that. And when you come up with an idea, you can get some people on board, but you lose others. You modify that deal, and then you lose some of the people you had. So that's another issue that complicates all of this. Scott Fitzgerald can only afford to lose two votes. He's got 19 members. You need 17 to pass a budget. No Democrat's going to vote for this budget. And, you know, prevailing wage, he's got two members that are saying if there are not very significant changes done to the prevailing wage law, they won't vote for the budget. And you've got two or more others who say if you go too far on prevailing wage, they're going to be very reluctant to vote.
The thing is, you're asking how a deal can get done. Well, politics is not just the art of compromise, but it's also the art of lowered expectations. And it's what things are they going to drop out, whether it's prevailing wage or one of these other things. What are they going to eventually say, this isn't going to happen now. It might happen next session, mm-hmm. but it's not going to happen now.
Well, who has to tell them that? Does the governor have to tell them that? Do the leaders have to tell the members that? I mean, who makes that decision that says, look, let's just push this aside and do a prevailing wage vote?
Well, you're going to have to make promises then, and it would have to be the leadership or the governor. But the governor's focus clearly is not here. I mean, he wants a deal done, and he has the power of vetoing later on. But this is being driven by Robin Voss and Scott Fitzgerald, so they would be the ones making the promises that these issues would be dealt with later.
Okay. All right, let's shift a little bit here to the big news in U.S. politics today, which is the Supreme Court ruling upholding, you know, some key parts of the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. There were some concerns that if it were rejected, you know, if the law was thrown out or that portion would create a bit of chaos here in Wisconsin. Can you talk a little bit, Dan, about what the reaction
is? Walker had said that there would be 184,000 people in the state who would be removed from the program, and that something would be need to be done. So, you know, you're not going to be dealing with all of those problems of what do you do with that 184,000, whether it's Badger Care or expansion of Medicaid or what you're going to do. Instead, the debate shifts, and you'll hear more from Walker and Paul Ryan as to what they think need to be done. And it's simple. They're going to say you need to repeal Obamacare and replace it with something else. That's where the debate's going to shift now.
So, Patrick, I mean, is this in a sense a benefit to the governor, at least that he doesn't have this chaotic issue on his plate as he's running for president? I know he doesn't want Obamacare to exist, but in the short term, is this a sort of a benefit to him?
Yeah, this would have added a new layer of complexity to the budget because, of course, there's this separate issue with Obamacare of the federal money that the state has rejected, and I think that would reopen that debate about are we going to set up our own exchange? Are we going to accept the Medicaid money? Walker has said no. Legislative leaders have said no. Now they can sort of put that issue behind them. So, yeah, it's a benefit in that it does not complicate things even further. It's a setback in the long-term goal of overturning Obamacare. Now the advocates for Obamacare can say it's been upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court twice, and that those who are opposed to it have to just come to reconcile and live with it.
Do you see this, Dan, Obamacare being an overturning, becoming a big issue in the presidential race next year? Is that one reason for Walker's stance of not accepting
it's going to be an issue in the Republican primary primarily, and so everyone will try to speak out more sharply and more critically of Obamacare during the debates and all of that. But there's not a great deal to distinguish the Republicans on that issue. So in the general election, of course, assuming Hillary Clinton wins, she'll be supportive of Obamacare if Walker would make it that far. I mean, there'll be a clear distinction between the two. It's also interesting to look into the Supreme Court. I mean, it looks like Justice Roberts has decided that there are a couple issues that he's going to focus on, racial preferences, Voting Rights Act, and that sort of stuff. But these other issues he's going to affirm and stay with the majority on.
Patrick, how do you think if among the voters out there, if you think more toward the general election, how are people feeling about Obamacare? Now it's been in place, key parts of it for several years now. Are people becoming more accepting, do you think, or is there still that great divide of a large chunk don't like it and a large chunk do like it?
Well, I think that if you ask people if they like Obamacare, they say no. And then if you ask people if they like particular parts about Obamacare, they say yes. I don't know that they're wild about alternatives to Obamacare. I don't know that they feel that they have details about what those alternatives would be. Clearly, when you talk to the most partisan voters, the feelings are very strong with Democrats, the most partisan Democrats feeling that it's a great thing, the most partisan Republicans feeling that it's the worst thing that we've had in 100 years. And I think there's a vast middle that's unsure what they think still, even after all these years, because it is a vast law, it's a complex law, and we haven't seen it full implementation in many ways because of all these, or we haven't seen it sort of off running smoothly because of court challenges and the glitches with the rollout of the website. So I think a lot of people are still hanging back to make their final.
But I think courts are. I think courts are very uncomfortable taking away something that already exists. I mean, that's a very hard thing to do when people already have something to pull it back, and as you said, could create chaos or something like that. I think the court probably realized that would be a difficult thing to do.
All right, well, we're going to leave it there on that segment and go now to a closer look at Governor Walker and his presidential fortunes. We're joined now by Craig Gilbert, our Washington bureau chief, to talk about Scott Walker and happenings on the presidential campaign front. So, Craig, I wanted to ask you about a story in the New York Times that looked at how Walker's faring back home with his Republican colleagues in the legislature. We've talked a lot about that as a state issue, but now we see it spilling over into the national conversation and raising some doubts, perhaps, about how well can Walker get things done here in Wisconsin, particularly on the state budget. What's your impression on that? Is this a potential problem for the governor?
Well, I think any political mess or crisis back home is a potential liability for a governor who's running for president. Of all the governors who are running for president, Walker has been in reasonably good shape so far. He's won three elections. He's not as unpopular in his state as Chris Christie and Bobby Jindal are in their states. But this problem with the budget is getting increasingly getting attention because of the timing of the governor's announcement for president. He's just about the last major candidate who hasn't yet formally announced, and he was putting off his announcement until after the budget was done. Now he's trying to give himself a little bit of wiggle room because the fact is he has to announce before the first Republican debate, which is August 6th. You have to be a declared candidate to be one of the 10 people on that stage. So he does actually have a date certain by which he has to announce, and so it can't drag much beyond mid-July.
Yeah, well, let's go back for a second on the budget. I mean, one of the governor's rationales of his campaign is, look, I can get things done. These guys in Washington just do a lot of talking. Look at Wisconsin where we get things done. Does that give us an extra problem for him here in that, he can't, it's not like he's dealing with a Democratic legislature. He's got Republicans.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, one of the reasons why Governor Walker and some other Republican governors have been able to brag about getting things done and compare themselves favorably to the gridlock in Washington is because their party has total control of their state government. I mean, in a lot of these states, because of the recent election cycles, they control the legislature and they control the governor's office. And that's the position Governor Walker has been in. And so it's a little more, I think, a little more awkward, maybe a little more embarrassing when the crisis involves your own party. And I think this will pass, obviously it will, but for the time being, I think it just, you know, is an unwanted complication for the governor. And you're right, his selling point is his political success back home in Wisconsin, a swing state. He talks about that all the time on the campaign trail. So anything that kind of casts a cloud over that is a potential liability.
All right. So you mentioned earlier most of the other major candidates or would-be candidates are in the race. You know, Jeb Bush entered the race last week. How do you think our governor, is faring in terms of these other folks out there? We always talk about him individually, what he's doing personally on the trail, but how is he faring these days against the other contenders?
Well, you know, you have to be tricky when you're talking about the polls. The national polls are an indicator of something, but they're not all that meaningful because they're volatile and because it's really the polling in the early states that matter, because once those early states start voting, you can throw out the early national polls because it changes everything. But Governor Walker's numbers have been as consistent as anybody's in this race, which I think does say something about his underlying appeal to Republican primary voters. I mean, his just sort of basic appeal, given his political bio in Wisconsin, the fights against the unions, the political successes, that just has a lot of staying power with Republican primary voters outside Wisconsin. I think you see that in the consistency of his numbers. He's not ahead in every national poll, but he's in the hunt. And so, and he's consistently been leading in the Iowa polling. So we've got one interesting thing to look at will be whether the governor's own announcement of candidacy coming at the end of all these other announcements has any impact on his numbers, because it's provided some other candidates with a bump. But in a sense, Governor Walker got his bump back in January when he gave that speech in Iowa that really set his candidacy in motion. So I'm not sure there's a whole lot of room for an additional bump once he announces.
All right, let me ask you briefly on one of the news events from this past week, of course, was the shooting in Charleston, South Carolina. From a political perspective, you know, the governor's taken some criticism for being a little, you know, hesitant perhaps to come out and say what he would do about the Confederate battle flag in South Carolina, deferring to the governor there. South Carolina is an early primary state. How do you think he handled that as just from a political standpoint?
I don't think he handled it great. I don't think he handled it terribly. He was, I think, very, very cautious, like most of the other candidates in the Republican field, who were all kind of looking for cover from Governor Haley of South Carolina. And so they were very reluctant to wade into this issue. I was with Governor Walker Saturday night in D.C. when he gave a speech to the Faith and Freedom Coalition, and he led that speech with some remarks about the shootings. But in a gaggle with reporters afterwards, he repeatedly deferred on the question of the flag. He wouldn't even talk about the flag as a symbol. He wouldn't talk about what should be done with the flag. He said there will be a debate about that. And he said that basically people in South Carolina had asked him to refrain from commenting on that until some time had passed. And then it really wasn't a whole lot of time that passed. It was basically 2 days that Governor Haley came out with her announcement. And right on the heels of that, Governor Walker endorsed it. And then today said that that was his position all along. So I think, you know, that's going to obviously invite some natural cynicism when Governor Walker is saying it was always his position to take down the flag, but he couldn't speak about it until Governor Haley spoke about it. But he kind of shared that caution with a lot of other candidates in the Republican field.
All right. Well, we're going to have a little more discussion about that coming up next on our show. So thank you, Craig, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Great.
All right, we're back live now. I'm joined by opinion columnist James Causey on my left, appropriately enough, and Christian Schneider on my right. I've got my red and blue tie on, so I'm kind of officially in the middle. Christian, you heard what Craig Gilbert was saying about the South Carolina, the flag, and how the governor responded. What was your take on how the governor did, just from a political standpoint, in his response?
Yeah, I mean, I think he pretty much took a knee right off the bat, which, you know, a lot of the candidates did, and now he said, as Craig just told you, that Governor Haley told him to not comment so she could come out and make her big announcement. A lot of people, I think, on this issue, flag or no flag, anytime a big emotional thing like this happens, they wonder, what can we really do? Like, what do we do about this? And I think the public right now is like, well, gun control, maybe that would have made a difference, maybe it wouldn't have, but hey, there's this flag thing out there. So they go ahead and they do the flag, and in the end, I think James had it right in his column. I mean, it's gone, and that's good, and I think a lot of people are for that, but in the end, what difference is it really going to make?
Well, James, staying with Walker for a minute, mm-hmm. I mean, what was your take on his response? He didn't immediately come out and say this is a bad thing on the flag. He did make some strong statements about the racism involved in the shooting in Charleston, but what was your...
I think he played it a little bit too safe. For a leadership, I would have liked to see him be more aggressive. I understand that he was, as Christian said, taking a knee, but you want leadership. This is a guy that's about to enter the presidential race, so it wouldn't have hurt him to just come out and say, no, it's wrong, and it needs to come down. But there's so much more to be done. I mean, there's roads and streets named after Confederate generals and things like that right there in that area. So the flag is one thing, but it's so much more that needs to be done.
Well, why do those things remain, important? I mean, symbolically, it's a big change, obviously, to do it. But to make all these changes, the flag, why are those things so important?
Why shouldn't it be important? I mean, the rebel flag has been known as to African Americans been a symbol of oppression for decades, and it goes back as far as I mentioned in my column. I didn't understand it at first. I remember I used to watch the Dukes of Hazzard like most of us did.
I was never allowed to watch it.
Like most of us did, and we saw the Confederate flag on the General Lee, and it was cool, this car doing all these jumps and things like that. But I didn't really truly understand it until my grandfather in the South in Mississippi took me around and I saw all these Confederate flags and white business windows and establishments like that, and I never saw African-American showing the flag, and it helped me understand exactly what it meant. So it's deep. It's deeper than just a flag. It goes, it's deep in our roots, and it needs to be addressed.
I think there are a lot of these issues out there that are, I think a lot of the Republican candidates who kind of, like I said, took a knee off the bat, I think they would have said, get rid of the flag, if not, for it being a primary state and all that kind of stuff. They were a little afraid of the voters. And so it took Nikki Haley to come out and essentially give them permission to do what they kind of thought was right all along. And I'm just wondering how many issues there are out there. Like, as soon as one person does it, like, all the dominoes will fall. Other issues out there, it just takes one person.
That's the question. I think it's really sort of this dynamic of a big political field, especially on the Republican side running, so you're kind of like, you're measuring what you do against what he does and what he does and what she does,
right,
versus just saying, this is what my gut tells me to do.
Right, and then it just takes that one person to kind of give permission to the rest of the field to go ahead and do it, and then it gets done.
But is that really what we want? Do we want leadership, or do we want people to just play it so safe that they don't make any mistakes so they don't get criticized by the others?
Well, once you make a mistake in the presidential race, you just get crushed on Twitter and everywhere else. And so I think everybody else is, a little too timid these days.
The key is it may not be a mistake.
Yeah. Let's shift topics a little bit. There's discussion out there, the $10 bill. You wrote a column about that. Who should go on there? They're going to put put a female on there.
Mm-hmm.
There's some debate, $10 bill, $20 bill. What bill should it be? Who's your choice?
Yeah, I mean, the big debate out there is, well, do we do Jackson on the 20 or Hamilton on the 10? And I'm all for, diversifying our money a little bit. I mean, there's Grant died in, I think, 1885, and I think he's the most recent living person on the bill. But I just like to see diversity of, life experience, because everybody we have on there is either a president or has something to do with the federal government. I think there are people out there who have done a lot more important things in America, and I would say Harriet Tubman would be one of them. She actually didn't work for the government, but she put herself at grave physical risk to work on the Underground Railroad. So she'd be my pick.
I love that pick too, but you know, even keeping with diversity, Mother Teresa would be another choice. You know, there's so Martin Luther King Jr. You could just take your pick. You could go on and on.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll have new dollar bills by the, maybe a payday will come in new dollars, you know, in a week or two.
That's about how much I get paid in singles.
It doesn't matter as long as the money.
Okay, so the Bucks arena, we talked a little bit about it earlier, is one of the stumbling blocks. Mm-hmm. Today's a big day for the Bucks with the draft. The arena, what do we get this done? There was talk about a surcharge on there for tickets now. What? How do we get this resolved?
Yeah, I was hoping you were going to ask me about the draft, but.
Let me get to that.
Yeah, I mean, the column that I wrote last week was essentially trying to put the cost of the arena in perspective. And, you know, they're arguing about it in Madison, essentially what the state share is going to be. Mm-hmm. And when you put it in perspective, the entire budget and kind of what the building budget is, I mean, there was a science lab in La Crosse that they just authorized last year that was $82 million, which is more than the state share would be for the arena. But the arena's in the news every day, so suddenly it becomes this, you know, politically charged issue up there. So what they're basically asking for is $4 million a year for 20 years. In the grand scheme of things, you know, that's not that big of a deal. But, you know, things still have to get worked out, obviously.
Well, in a way, James, this has become sort of a Milwaukee versus outstate kind of issue. I mean, as Christian pointed out, the amounts that were spent on different building programs and projects in other places right. don't blink an eye. I mean, is that what's the problem, do you think, that people are sort of anti-Milwaukee with that money, or what's driving that?
I wish it was that simple. It is some anti-Milwaukee there, but I think people still don't understand how important our arena is. They just see it as just a millionaire's playground. But I think I've taken my daughter over the past year or two to the BMO for more than just basketball. We went there for Marquette games, we went there for Disney on Ice, we went there for all these other events, plays, concerts, and all that other stuff. It's just not just a basketball facility. And I think people, that's what they think of, and they say, I don't want to pay for this. Millionaires play for that. And I even heard one person saying that in the draft tonight, the Bucks are going to shell over millions of dollars to an unproven player. And they're still trying to get money from me. Well, it's just bigger than that. And I don't think people understand that.
All right, well, before we leave the Bucks, we'll have to ask you guys, who do they get in their pick tonight? What position do they need? Who's your call?
I think they should address the power forward position at 17 if they stay there. If not, trade up and see if they could get a big man.
Yeah, I mean, a guy like Portis from Arkansas, I think he is. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody that could fill the spot left by Larry Sanders, who's out traveling the world doing whatever. Right. And they're still paying him $5 million a year. But yeah, I think that's what they need to do.
I'm going to go with, they're going to get one of the Wisconsin guys, including Kevon Looney in there as a
Milwaukee like
native. They all seem to fall right in that range, and then it'll be maybe too good for them to pass up.
Right.
All right, let's go to our reader questions now. And this one goes right to the Bucks Arena. This is from Back Again, who says, why don't these politicians get it? We don't want to spend any money on a Bucks Arena. None. Why don't these politicians get it? Some people are, that's the mindset of some folks out there.
Well, what do you want to spend money on is the question. You know, when you say you don't want to spend money on arena, do you want to spend money on roads? Do you want to spend money on public education? What do you want to spend money on? Because no one wants their taxes to go up. I mean, I don't want my taxes to go up, but if it goes to the benefit that everyone could get something out of, I don't mind it. So,
let me throw this one to Christian. This is from Freddie One. He says, with the need for more money to support our roads, the Gov said he would veto raising the gas and registration fees. What are your thoughts about raising the needed money through the liquor tax, which has not been raised since the 1960s?
It's a wonderful thought, never going to happen, not in the state of Wisconsin. You know, there have been bills out there to raise the liquor tax. It's just the wrong state to do it.
Why?
It's culturally ingrained in the state, and I don't know.
But we have one of the lowest liquor taxes in the nation, so it needs to be raised, and we could generate a lot of money to pay for a lot of things with that.
Yeah, I mean, typically I think the argument becomes, well, the gas tax relates directly to the roads because you're driving on the roads, and the liquor tax, or maybe it's sort of would be the anti-drunken driving tax, I guess.
And a lot of people look at the liquor tax as affecting the common man who just wants to have a beer at home at night.
All right, so this is from Ricky T. who says, how can the Republican Party reconcile their legislation to allow teachers in the state of Wisconsin to teach with only a bachelor's degree or no degree at all with their constant plan to close Milwaukee public schools that are failing because of quality of teacher performance and test scores? So there is sort of a bit of a disconnect, it seems, there. We say, you know, we're going to maybe lower the teacher standards, at least in some views, but we need better teachers. Who wants to take that one?
Yeah, I mean, I think the initial budget provision that was proposed, it was misunderstood a little bit. And in fairness, it was actually drafted pretty poorly because you had, well, they need a bachelor's degree for these four subject areas, but then laid on top of that is the federal law that has, you have to have a degree for these other areas, and so it didn't really match up, and so it was kind of confusing. But I don't think it's at all, it doesn't contradict the school takeover plan at all. I mean, a lot of when they take over the schools, the teachers are going to have bachelor's degrees. They're going to be licensed, a lot of them. So it's just a different way of educating kids, and just not the status quo, the same thing we see over and over again.
All right, that's where we'll leave it for today. We'll be back next week when we may or may not be talking about a budget deal, depending if you believe Scott Walker or Senator Fitzgerald. But stay tuned and have a good week.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.